Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of F This Movie, the only podcast that asks the question, who are you going to call?
Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Do I have that right? Who are you going to call?
No, I believe they use the contraction, sir, so it would scan.
Who are you going to call? Who are you going to call?
That was a later X-rated remake called Whorebusters. I don't think any of you want to know how they did the actual busting in that one.
You know what the tagline was?
What was that?
Bustin' makes them feel good. Hi, welcome to F This Movie. Joining me again tonight. Oh, my name's Patrick, by the way, and joining me again tonight, my main man, John, JB, J Bones, right? We decided J Bones was your name?
We never decided
that. I think we did. Tonight we're talking about Ghostbusters from 1984.
Wow. It was a long time ago.
Over 25 years old.
It's true, and I still remember the weekend it opened. We all stood in line. There was a really long line, which back then was more common than today because there were fewer screens and fewer showtimes. But it was the Friday that it opened, and everybody wanted to see it. Who wouldn't? And there was a big long line at the Woodfield 1 and 2, mm-hmm. The late lamented Woodfield 1 and 2. And it was raining, I remember, so it was pretty miserable in line. And we got in, and we got seated, and the movie started, and two guys down front began to cause a ruckus, and they were shouting things at the screen.
Sure.
And me, who even back then was even still, a ball of self-righteousness, yelled in my loudest and most commanding voice, "I didn't pay X." And I don't remember what X was, but they had recently hiked the price at Woodfield.
So it was probably like $4.25.
It was like the first movie where they were charging a new price.
Right.
But I shouted, "I didn't pay X and stand in the rain to listen to you." And I got a standing ovation.
Wow.
And the movie started, and I said, "I'm going to shout things in movie theaters more." That taught me a very bad lesson.
The sad ending to that story, those two men killed themselves.
I made them realize how meaningless their lives were. It's my job.
Before we start talking about Ghostbusters, have you seen anything good lately?
Wow. No, I've seen some movies that were pleasantly mediocre. My son and I are putting together this little DVD for me to use in film study class, which tries to teach sort of basic film grammar, basic film terminology with little clips from movies that demonstrate it. And looking at all these clips, I've formed a new theory that movies used to be awesome, and now they're not.
Movies are the worst.
And I think that's the reason why everybody, for good or bad, went gaga over Inception. Because it's the first movie in a long time that's dense and well thought out and well plotted and doesn't insult you and actually gives you something to mull over and has an interesting idea behind it. It's got great cinematography. I mean, I can go on and on. That's such a shock to our system that's used to fill in your favorite mediocre summer film here,
right,
that suddenly everybody wanted to talk about it. And it was such an anomaly. But I'm watching these clips from the past, and I just keep thinking, you know, when Apocalypse Now came out, it was very controversial, and some people loved it, and some people really didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at that movie now,
right,
and it is this just the benefit of hindsight? Is this rose-colored glasses looking back at the past? Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? But where are the movies being made today that have the intellectual heft and the ambition of Apocalypse Now?
Right.
I don't see them.
Right. Was that? Would you say then that the late 70s, was that the end of it all?
Well, there's a lot of theories for this and the blockbuster mentality, and
right,
certain people point at certain films. That's sort of become a cliche, but I have to argue that in much the same way that we get the politicians we deserve, I think we get the movies we deserve,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it's not as if, well, we put out a whole bunch of good ones and you didn't go see them.
Right.
No, it's the opposite. We
right
put out a bunch of hooey,
right,
and it cleaned up.
Right.
and I don't want to jump the gun because we'll get to this at the end of the summer. Please note, Patrick will determine when the end of the summer is.
But it's when... after Piranha 3D, everyone.
That's
it's
what we've after decided.
After Piranha 3D.
After Piranha 3D,
it the started with Iron over. Man 2, and it ends with Piranha 3D.
As does so much in life. That when something like Grown Ups can gross, I mean, what is it?
150 million?
We're doomed.
Right.
So at least we can watch old movies on DVD. Nothing tremendous. Everything pleasantly mediocre. Although, I've noticed that a lot of people want to talk to me about Inception.
Yes.
That is a movie that at least is generating some discussion, which I think is good.
Yeah, it seems to be a movie that everyone is seeing or at least wants to see. And while not everyone is responding to it as much as we did, I'm glad people are talking about it. I'm glad that it's a movie that's getting attention. It's kind of an event. It's like a movie that people feel like they need to see to be part of the conversation.
Yes.
And
which used to happen all the time.
And it did just happen with Avatar, but of course, I'm much happier about it happening with Inception than I am with Avatar.
Yeah, the Avatar discussion was not one that I was interested in joining.
Right, but... and essentially boiled down to, did you see it? It was cool. You know, like, it was big, and it was in 3D. It was so cool. It was like a ride. But I don't go to movies to feel like I was on a ride. I go on rides to be on rides, and I don't go on rides.
And I think because of the expense of making movies and the expense of marketing them, and especially in the summer, more and more movies are becoming like a ride.
Right.
And like you said, I have very little interest in a ride, and much more of an interest in watching Apocalypse Now. Although I would argue that Christopher Nolan, in one way or another, I think deliberately fashioned parts of Inception to be like a ride, so that there was something to satisfy that audience. I mean, on one level, you can look at it as a twisted action film.
Right.
It's not completely esoteric and, you know, it's not like something from the mind of Ingmar Bergman. It's an American Hollywood film.
And some of the feedback I've heard consists of people responding to it sort of as an action film. Well, it was a pretty good action movie. And that's fascinating to me because while, yay, I applaud you for liking it, I'm discouraged that you seem to have missed most of what the movie was trying to say.
I think this movie is much more ambitious than Cobra.
Cobra was pretty ambitious. Marion Cobra Cobretti. Crime is the disease. He is the cure.
I must say, about a week ago, Cobra came up in conversation.
Because we were having a conversation, and Cobra always comes up in conversation.
And I know he doesn't want anyone to know this, but Patrick's favorite movie is Cobra. And then I went to see the other guys, and out of the blue...
There's a Cobra poster!
There's a poster for Cobra on somebody's wall.
On
Mark Wahlberg's wall, there's a Cobra poster, so... It's serendipity.
It's working its way back into the mainstream because this weekend Stallone has a movie out called The Expendables.
Imagine the fun.
Real quick, what did you think of the other guys?
It made me laugh. Adam McKay's movies make me laugh. I think he's very funny. I like Will Ferrell a lot. I think lately he's sort of gotten a bad rap. I think because he made so many movies in a row that were sort of the same. But... It's not a masterpiece, it's flawed, but it did make me laugh.
I find that Adam McKay's movies, I start to like them more the more times I see them.
Like you had said about Step Brothers.
Yeah, Step Brothers I came out of and said, I mean, it was funny at parts, but I didn't love it, and now if it's on cable, I gotta stop and watch it.
Patrick reviewed the other guys for About.com.
Correct.
Which you should all go to and read and subscribe to his email. Here's the weekly blog. I don't know what it's called. And I thought the point that you made about Adam McKay's movies all sort of being about hysterical American masculinity was really, really well thought out. It made me look at those movies in a different way, and I think it would give everyone sort of a different way, a different lens to look at those movies, because clearly it's very obvious in Anchorman.
Right.
But I began to think, I mean, three out of the four movies have a masculine word in the title. Anchorman, yeah. Stepbrothers, other guys, that Ricky Bobby's the only exception.
Right, right.
But if you look at them in an odd way as being similar to Jerry Lewis movies, as movies that have something to say about American masculinity, it's an interesting way to look at the films. I won't belabor the point.
All right. Let's talk Ghostbusters. So in preparing for this podcast, we both rewatched Ghostbusters.
We did. I did a few hours ago.
Yeah. I see Ghostbusters probably once a year. Because I would... Here's the thing. I've gotten in the habit lately, unfortunately, of choosing movies for F This Movie. I think The Wolfman was the last one I did that was really a movie that I kind of didn't like, and that's problematic, because the last few that I've done have all been movies that I really like. Right. So it turns into an hour of just, this movie, it's the Chris Farley show. It turns into an hour of,
Awesome. Do you remember right? when he said, I got slime?
Right. That was awesome. So I don't necessarily try and make it a habit of choosing all of my favorite movies, but this actually came from a listener request. Someone wrote in to fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com, which you can also do, and requested that we talk about Ghostbusters. So we're going to do it. What do you think about Ghostbusters?
I love Ghostbusters. I loved it then. I love it now.
That's the correct answer.
And for those of you playing the test game at home, that was answer choice C.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I remember maybe a year after it came out, I bought a book called The Making of Ghostbusters. For those of you who forget what books were, because you're listening to this podcast, and you agree with Harold Ramis when he says, print is dead. It was called The Making of Ghostbusters, and it was an oversized paperback with black and white and color pictures and the conceptual drawings they had done of the special effects and how difficult it was to do the special effects because they were really under the gun to get this out by the release date, and interviews with Richard Edlund and the special effects crew, and interviews with Ivan Reitman. And looking back, it was very much like the special features on a DVD. Only this was before there were DVDs, so you bought it as a book.
Yeah.
But a lot of those were cheap, awful rip-offs, cash-ins. But the Making of Ghostbusters book was really wonderful. I don't remember the author or who put it together, but it was great. And that was that showed my allegiance to the film because you know, I wanted to know more about it. I wanted to know how it was made.
I wanted to see Ghostbusters very, very badly in 1984, and I was young, and we didn't go to movies much, and my mom had promised to take me, and she never did, so parents out there, don't think your kids will ever forget when you break a promise. But I wanted to see it so bad that I was trying to figure out, I was trying to construct the plot based on the commercials and the clips from the Ray Parker Jr. video for the song Ghostbusters. I was putting together what happens in the movie just based on the clips. And I was way off base, by the way, when I finally saw it.
And I still remember the Ray Parker Jr. video because it did have clips from the film.
Yeah.
But it had little cameos.
Right. Of people saying Ghostbusters, right?
And I Ain't Afraid of No Ghost. Right, right. And Who Are You Gonna Call?
Right.
And people who weren't even in the film. Right. So it was like this little happy menagerie of friends of the filmmakers, because I remember John Candy was in it.
Yeah.
Remember Terry Garr was in it. Seriously.
Garr was a movie star in 1984.
Okay, and I wanted to ask you if you originally saw this in a theater.
I did not.
Because in 1984, you were two.
I was one and a half. No, I was 7 years old, and I did not see it in a theater. But I did eventually because the AMC near our house in like the late 90s, early 2000s, started doing midnight shows of older movies. And they showed Ghostbusters, and I was able to see a terrible 35mm print of Ghostbusters. And in the theater was a group of Ghostbusters fans dressed as Ghostbusters.
Okay.
They ran around to every movie theater at the 30-screen multiplex and charged into every movie as the Ghostbusters. And it was very amusing to watch.
Well, you have to. And that's not an easy costume. It looks like an easy costume because of the coveralls, but you need the proton pack, and it's very easy
to see
when someone has fashioned one out of empty toilet paper tubes and black duct tape. A couple weeks ago, I went to the Famous Monsters convention in Indianapolis, and sure enough, there were five young men portraying the Ghostbusters with very impressive. Not only were the jumpsuits movie accurate with the patches and everything, but the proton packs were, I don't think this is an item you can purchase. You guys have studied the film very carefully.
Were they all white? Or was there a black Ghostbuster?
I'd have to check because I took a picture of them with my phone.
Because I just wonder, at that point, are you so slavishly devoted to recreating the Ghostbusters that you actually befriend a black person just to have a Winston Zeddemore in your group?
If memory serves, these four gentlemen were Caucasians.
This is utterly inauthentic.
No, it wasn't. Although, ironically, and boy, the memories you dredge up, Mr. Bromley, Ernie Hudson was one of the guests at the convention.
Oh, really?
I didn't put that together
he
until
has not
just
aged,
now.
By the way.
And he was a fan favorite.
He's a cool guy.
His table was swamped. He was very, very nice to everyone and telling stories, and unlike bad celebrities at a convention, he was very, very nice. His table was constantly full of people talking and taking pictures and getting autographs, because if you've ever been to a convention of any kind, you know the sorry sight of the celebrity with the empty table.
Right.
Where everyone walks by as if they're shopping at Walmart and they're in an aisle full of things they don't buy. Like they've suddenly discovered themselves in the cat food aisle and they don't have a cat. And it's uncomfortable for the celebrity unless they're drunk or stoned. It's really uncomfortable for you.
Right. Not the person walking by, but you watching this take place. That's awful.
But I realize perhaps they were dressed up for that reason. There was nothing else at the convention devoted to Ghostbusters. Although sometimes at conventions you just see people dressed up as, obviously, this person has a fixation on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Right.
And they're here at the annual Cubs convention, but they really like Buffy. Like, their costume has no rhyme or reason. But I now realize that's why they were dressed that way. And I wonder what Ernie Hudson had to say about no black Ghostbusters.
I guess we should jump into like Ghostbusters as a whole. But since we're talking about Ernie Hudson and Winston Zeddemore, watching the movie again last night, what function do you think is served by the Ernie Hudson character?
Well,
what is the point in bringing him into the story?
I think it's interesting because it's a really interesting supporting role. Mm-hmm. I think he's really great in the movie.
Yeah.
And he's really not given that much to do. But it's interesting in that Aykroyd and Ramis have this script where suddenly the Ghostbusters are getting all this business and they're swamped and they need more help, which is interesting. But on a deeper level, I think the script needs Ernie Hudson specifically to have a more working class point of view, because we're presented with Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis, who are shown to at least be fake academics.
Right.
They're from college. It's revealed that Aykroyd spent some time in the private sector. He doesn't like it. And you get the feeling that the only real intellectual in the group is Ramis. So Zeddemore, Hudson, balances that out. And it's especially useful in the scene where he talks to the mayor and he says, look, I've only been with these guys a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to repeat the line. It's one of my favorite lines in the film. We're not going to turn this into a love fest for Ghostbusters, but every line in this movie is great.
It's one of the most quotable movies ever.
It really is.
It's unbelievable. I liked watching it again. I thought the same thing, that Winston sort of becomes an audience surrogate of sorts. It's a little underdeveloped in that respect because you really are still sticking with the main three, but he is sort of the identifiable one, and I liked that scene with him and Aykroyd driving in the car where they start bringing up religion.
Yeah.
That he's sort of the religious one in the group. I thought that was an interesting point of view to include amongst these three academics.
And that's mirrored in the scene where we discover that the mayor has the cardinal there,
right,
as one of his advisors, who turns out to be very politically savvy, as it turns out, with his little smile. But I thought it was so great that in this movie that's this sort of enjoyable, fun summer special effects comedy, that you get this very genuine character saying, I'm paraphrasing, but not very much, that he really digs everything that Jesus did. And there's another theory about the film. I wish I could give this credit, but I read this ages ago. And as I rewatched the film, I wondered what Mr. Bromley would think of this. Obviously, Ghostbusters was successful. And before the podcast started, Patrick was telling me just how successful it was.
I think in adjusted dollars, it grossed about $550 million or something, over $500 million in adjusted dollars.
And you had said that when it was first released,
It was number one for several weeks, and then it was knocked out of the top spot for about a week, and then it came back, and then it was knocked out again, and then 6 weeks later, it returned to the number one spot. So 6 weeks later, enough people were still going to see Ghostbusters, whether for the first time or, I'm assuming, there were a number of repeat audience members, to make it number one in the country again.
So clearly it was a success because it's wonderfully shot and wonderfully written and wonderfully acted, and it's very, very funny. But the critical essay that I read suggested that there was another reason that at the time this movie was released, it might have been successful. Now, I don't know if I subscribe to this, so let me bounce this off you.
Okay.
What Ghostbusters is really about is a free enterprise and entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
And the author in question, and again, I want to give credit where credit is due. This is not original to me. I just don't remember the name of the author. Is that what we have in Ghostbusters is this little story where three men who are living on the public dollar, mm-hmm, are forced to go into business for themselves and are tremendously successful as entrepreneurs. This was the Reagan dream,
right,
that everyone, the ownership society, all of that thing. And it's interesting when you look at the film in that light that once the Ghostbusters do become successful, because remember, when they get that loan at the beginning of the film, they're very worried,
right,
because the interest alone for the first 5 years is $95,000, which in 1984 was a lot of money. Not only do they become successful beyond their wildest dreams, but they're able to hire minorities, which,
right,
that sort of trickle-down economics thing. But what really makes this film a relic of the Reagan era is Reagan Republicans don't like big government.
Right.
So they are removed from the private, they're removed from the public sector, they enter the private sector, they're tremendously successful, and who's the villain? The EPA, that horrible government agency, mm-hmm, that just won't leave businesses alone. And it works in the film, mostly because William Atherton made a career playing the same sniveling prick in every movie.
Right.
But the minute you take a step back, I don't think the EPA is a villain in very many things.
No. It certainly would only happen in 1984, because if this movie were made now, there's no way the EPA would be the villain. And for all the reasons you just named, Ghostbusters actually pretty recently showed up on a list in the National Review as one of the 25 best conservative movies ever made. For all the reasons you just named. But that's, of course, completely bogus, because it's saying, yeah, they were in the, you know, these public university intellectuals have to go into the private sector. And even Dan Aykroyd says, I was in the private sector. It's hard, you know.
They expect results.
Right. That's the line. The private sector expects results. So that's really, you know, where the conservatives' heart is at. And Walter Peck from the EPA. But you could just as easily turn around and make the argument that it's these three university-trained academics who saved the world.
But the other thing I was thinking as I was pondering this earlier today and watching the film again is this becomes really weird and twisted when you consider that the film is really about some things that most conservatives would be against. That is, ghosts and the occult,
right,
and the existence of Harry Potter-like witchery and tomfoolery. But then what really cements it as a Reagan-era parable is, at least from what I've read, the Reagan White House, specifically Reagan and his wife, loved mysticism. And they had astrologists on the payroll.
No kidding.
And they were constantly looking for, sort of otherworldly advice. So it's certainly something worth chewing on.
Yeah. So it's interesting that we have sort of pegged it as this movie that's very much of its time, because really, I think Ghostbusters is incredibly timeless and holds up better than most comedies, particularly made in the 80s. But I think there are a few signifiers that, okay, this is made in the 80s, whether it's the few pop songs that you had pointed out earlier, or, not really even the clothes that much. The fact that everyone's smoking all the time. Okay, that's,
this which is not... I really noticed
earlier
today, specifically Aykroyd, which I thought was another attempt, either that they had a product placement I'm unaware of and they were contractually obligated to smoke. But if you look at the team, it seems as if the Aykroyd character is much closer to the earth, is much closer to being working class than the other two. He said he's been in the private sector. And also, he's shown working on the car when Sigourney Weaver comes in, and he's like a lot of Aykroyd characters, very mechanically proficient.
And without ever exactly picking up on that, I've always picked up on that.
Yeah, and it's interesting because besides the fashions, which I think are generic and muted and not faddish enough, along with the haircuts, I think one of the things that makes this movie not date is its score, which, except for the two pop songs, is a standard orchestral score. And as I was saying earlier today, I think all of comedy, at least good comedies, owe a debt of gratitude to John Landis, who decided when he made Animal House, which really could have had a jokey, stupid, annoying score, that Landis had it scored like a regular movie, and my God, hired Elmer Bernstein, the guy who had written the theme for The Magnificent Seven, which later became a cigarette commercial, and he wrote the score to Kill a Mockingbird. And man, how he was able to get Elmer Bernstein, I'll never know, but that's another thing, besides the fact that it's a period film, that doesn't date Animal House. So I'm watching the film again, and I can't remember, and lo and behold, the score of Ghostbusters is by Elmer Bernstein. And it's a really clever score, because you all probably remember the scene where Murray enters Sigourney Weaver's apartment and tinkles two piano keys he makes a joke that the ghosts hate it, and he's driving them away or something. But later in the film, right before something scary happens, Bernstein repeats that same two-key piano motif.
Now we have to watch Ghostbusters
before
again.
Something really scary. If you give me 1 second, I can find it. Right, it's in the same scene. You might even argue it's not foreshadowing, but right before Murray opens the fridge,
we get
that same thing repeated, which is clever and not annoyingly.
And then he makes fun of what she eats.
Yeah, which I think is interesting, because another reason why the film doesn't date is because I think the effects are really good.
Yeah.
And I'm sure people are divided about this, but I'm not a fan of CGI.
No, I was thinking this last night. I like how all of the effects have kind of a handmade tactile quality.
And
to
when
them.
The terror dogs run, you can sort of tell that it's animated and it's stripped in.
Right.
But when the terror dogs are staying still, they're huge rubber puppets, which are really impressive.
Right.
But the only special effect I've never been a fan of in this film is what we see when Sigourney Weaver opens her fridge. It's just odd and weird and offhand that suddenly there's a little altar, there's a miniature representation of the top of the building. It's just weird. It would have been better not that I'm trying to remake the film or saying it's not good because it's not what I would have done, that when she opens the fridge, it should have been something scary? Or how about this? In much the same way that we never see Slimer, that little cute, chubby, green eating ghost, we never see him actually touch or go through Bill Murray. He's going to attack.
Right.
We cut away.
Right.
We come back to Murray. He slimed me.
Right.
Maybe we have Dana open the fridge. We see her scared reaction, and we never see what was in the fridge.
Sure.
Because that special effect to me just seems odd and weird.
It's interesting that you bring up John Landis, because as you're saying all that about Landis, I was sitting here thinking, boy, I bet John Landis would have actually been a really good director for Ghostbusters. And that's not to take anything away from Ivan Reitman, who I think did a really good job with the movie, but I think this is one of those movies where it's just almost an act of chance that so many perfect elements fell into place.
Yeah.
I think this kind of alchemy is not something you can necessarily create. I think you almost luck into it. But I was thinking as I was watching it about Ivan Reitman and how he is sort of this, he's seen almost as a comedy auteur. But I don't think there's anything particularly remarkable about his direction in Ghostbusters, except that he sort of gets out of the way. But maybe I'm discrediting him, because the movie is so great, it didn't direct itself, as they say.
I would take that a step farther, though. I don't think he quite gets out of the way, but I think Ghostbusters directed by John Landis would be very, very different.
Because, too manic, maybe?
Because I think what Reitman does, and that more comedy directors should do, is... the script is funny, mm-hmm. and the performances are funny. But my feeling is Reitman approaches this as a movie that's very serious.
Right.
It has comic characters and comic situations in it, but it has, I don't want to say staid, I'm trying to think of the right adjective, it takes itself seriously.
I don't mean to change topics, but that brings up something that, again, as I'm watching it last night, I was thinking about, and it was that scene that we mentioned earlier where Winston and Ray are driving in the car and having sort of this serious conversation about end-of-the-world type stuff. And this is before stuff really starts to hit the fan, but I was watching it thinking what a good job the movie does of conjuring up an actual impending sense of doom.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of the movie Watchmen, which is a movie I like a lot. But one of my big problems with Watchmen is that for the character's motivations at the end of that movie to work or make sense, we truly have to feel like the end of the world is at stake, that the fate of all mankind is in jeopardy.
And we never do.
And the movie never gives us that sense. And here's this wacky comedy from 1984 that I think does a great job of that. And I also really like that as they build up to that, this is after the Ghostbusters are released out of jail, they're going to climb up the building to save the world, the ground opens up and threatens to swallow them, so we have this big moment of, okay, things are really serious and the end of the world is coming. And then the movie sucks all the air out of that by having this funny sequence of them having to climb up 22 flights of stairs that it takes a few steps back before resetting. I don't know. I like that a lot.
Given the characters in the film, specifically Bill Murray, who's very sarcastic and very ironic and very tongue-in-cheek, we have his character. I really think not the ultimate, but sort of the blueprint for Bill Murray characters, mm-hmm. at least until Lost in Translation.
Yeah.
And at no point does anyone look at the camera, smirk at the camera.
Right.
At no point is there a joke. This is only a movie,
right.
folks.
Right.
And I give it a lot of credit for that, because we have to take the central conflict seriously. That makes some of the jokes work better, specifically the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man at the end, because it's the contrast between the Destroyer and Mr. Stay Puft.
Which, unfortunately, I think it's almost impossible to wrap your head around how funny that is now, because it becomes such a part of our culture.
Yes.
And when I saw the movie, it had already been turned into a toy and a cartoon, or the surprise was spoiled for me. And as a young kid, I probably couldn't have even appreciated it. But every time I watch it, I think, boy, how funny is that visual of the giant marshmallow man coming to destroy New York?
And even when you watch it again, they say that none of them thought of anything. Aykroyd looks incredibly guilty. We kind of see it, but
right.
we don't.
Right.
And then you get this beautiful close-up with this beautiful long pause, and Aykroyd says, "It's the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man." And I can still remember the audience reaction. But watching it again today, I realized just how much foreshadowing the movie has completely, but how much we're set up for that. And maybe upon first viewing, it might even be subliminal. When Sigourney Weaver gets home with the groceries and the eggs begin to cook,
yeah.
there's a big package yeah. of Stay Puft Marshmallows.
Which is very clever because they're inventing a brand, so it needs to exist
right.
in their world.
But later, when the roof blows off of the Ghostbusters firehouse,
yeah.
on the building next to them, painted on the bricks, like one of those old advertising signs
yeah.
that no one's ever painted over, is an ad for Stay Puft
wow.
Marshmallows with the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. So someone in the art direction department is very clever in this film.
Ghostbusters is incredible. I just want to say that again.
Another reason it's so great, and Patrick and I were talking about this before, is, and I can't understand why later Aykroyd scripts didn't take advantage
mm-hmm.
of this, in his Saturday Night Live routines and also in Ghostbusters, Aykroyd's incredible facility for spinning things that sound so accurate,
mm-hmm.
but I'm guessing are total nonsense. Unless, of course, there is a Spates catalog or the Tobin Spirit Guide. And this comes down to the names of all the otherworldly characters.
Right.
Patrick and I once thought that at the end of the film, Rick Moranis was Vince, V-I-N-C-E, like Vincent, Vince Clortho. But as it turns out, Patrick turned the closed captioning on, it's Vins, V-I-N-Z, which is much more middle-aged Sumerian. Vins Clortho and Zool and Gozer the Gozerian.
Right.
This is on par with W.C. Fields of just amazing bullshit that
right.
sounds correct.
And Aykroyd and Harold Ramis have sort of the unenviable task of trying to get all that kind of silly exposition out, and they do it beautifully, and they do it just totally straight-faced. But the true master of it, and the movie was so smart to do this, to give that long speech to Rick Moranis right after he becomes Vins Clortho, where he gives a long speech that's almost entirely nonsense, but he does it in that Rick Moranis, Louis Tully character voice.
And at one point he's talking
about
a
horse. Giant slore, you know, that whole speech about the giant slore and many somethings roasted in the fire. I mean, it's incredibly, incredibly funny. And when I first saw Ghostbusters, I couldn't appreciate who all was in the movie. You know, because I was too young and I wasn't a comedy nerd yet. So I think I knew Bill Murray. That might have been it. Maybe Dan Aykroyd. But I didn't know who Harold Ramis was. I didn't know who Rick Moranis was. I didn't know that this movie had a bunch of sort of comedy all-stars. And watching it now, it's incredible to see the cast that they put together. Even Sigourney Weaver, I think, is very, very good in this movie.
Very, very good. And underrated as a comedic actress.
Yeah.
Talk about someone who's taking this seriously.
Right,
and not
right.
playing.
And she kind of is what makes it work, because you really are invested. You feel scared for her.
And a rarity in an American comedy, she's smart and she's strong
right.
and she's not scared and particularly and she's not ditzy. Where I really appreciated Sigourney Weaver's performance today is in a special effects shot at the top of the building.
Mm-hmm.
She and Moranis are hit by some sort of lightning
mm-hmm.
and turn back into the terror dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And she does this amazing mm-hmm. little wavy full body dance before the special effect takes over and she becomes the dog.
Right.
I could just imagine them filming that.
Yeah, right.
And
It's hard not to feel silly doing something like that, but she commits to it.
And it works.
Yeah,
it's
right.
It's like, boy, that...
Right. That's... Her floating over the bed, same thing.
Yeah.
She's asked to do a lot of sort of weird things in that scene. But again, it never stops being funny, even though... I really liked the scene watching it again, because Bill Murray instantly knows that something is up, but he never has to be told. He's never made to be a fool.
And even at one point, and this almost comes across like a Warner Brothers cartoon, he sort of does a funny voice and says something like, "Let's go for it." And then he says, "No." that he's been lusting after her
right,
for the whole
right.
film. And now she's saying, "I want you inside of me." It doesn't get much more.
And there's one too many people in there already.
Yeah.
He tells
a funny line. You know, one thing I thought, and
yeah.
it's so short, maybe it doesn't warrant mention. Dan Aykroyd's dream of the floating...
That was the next thing I was going to bring up.
The floating dream lover. And for some reason, he's dressed as some sort of captain with epaulets on his shoulders.
I have to assume that comes from a longer deleted sequence.
And it's really weird.
And there's no reason to leave it in because it's part of a montage of business booming. And the talk shows, they're a media sensation, and they're on the magazine covers, and Larry King is talking about them, and they have commercials on TV, and all of a sudden we cut to one character's dream of a ghost who unzips his fly, and that's it.
So they're so busy, he's dreaming about these ghosts. For some reason, he's some sort of captain.
And but even that they're so busy, I think you are assigning too much meaning to it.
No, I'm not. I don't think it belongs in the film. I think it's weird, it's from another film.
Yeah.
You get to see Aykroyd make a funny face. Maybe they had filmed the special effect and said, well, you know, we spent the money on the floating woman. Or maybe they felt
like Ray sort of is underdeveloped.
Which I don't think is true.
I don't either. I think he's perfect. And I was saying this to you earlier, that as I've gotten older and watched Ghostbusters a lot, I appreciate different elements of it. To the point where I see now, you know, when I was a kid, Bill Murray was the funny one. He had all the good jokes, right. And he was the one I laughed at. But as you get older, you appreciate the things that Aykroyd and especially Harold Ramis are doing, because every line Harold Ramis says is funny.
Well, and he can assure that because he co-wrote the script.
Right.
At the very beginning of the film, when they're fighting a ghost, wait, I take that back. I think it's in the hotel with the little green chubby Slimer. When Aykroyd first sees the ghost, he lets his cigarette dangle from his mouth, like it's just attached to his lip, and it's straight down, and it's very funny. But the other thing you were talking about in terms of Aykroyd's character being underdeveloped, I think it's interesting that he mortgages his house to put them in business. Mm-hmm. And earlier he said he's been in the private sector. So again, he's shown to be the more middle class one, the one who has more at stake,
right. Whatever
you want to say. And I think in ways much subtler than Bill Murray or Dan Aykroyd, I think he establishes his character.
And Aykroyd, I think, is sort of the character that carries you through the beginning parts of the movie because, like in real life, how Dan Aykroyd is obsessed with the paranormal and the supernatural, and he's a big believer in all these sort of ghosts and all that kind of thing. But he seems to be the character who loves this, who gets joy from this, that Spengler is in it for the science, and Murray is in it for the money, but Dan Aykroyd is excited, and it's his enthusiasm that carries you through. And obviously, I mean, the most obvious example is where he slides down the fire pole, and he's so excited about that.
We have to sleep here tonight.
Right. But he's like a kid. Throughout the movie, he's super excited about finding out new things, and every time he learns about a new ghost, or, you know, when other people should be getting scared, he only grows more and more giddy with excitement.
And partially giddy with his knowledge. There's, again, we're gonna resort to Chris Farley. I love this talk, but the scene in the prison cell when he's bouncing things off of Bill Murray, and Bill Murray's completely uncomprehending, and Aykroyd winds up saying, "You never studied." And clearly Aykroyd is a character who gets a lot out of his knowledge, who's very proud of his knowledge. I wish there was more people like him. So I was rewatching the film, and the scene where Lewis Tully, Rick Moranis, is chased by... I love that when the terror dog first appears, no one's quite sure what it is. Mm-hmm. So he screams he's being chased by a bear. Mm-hmm. Later, someone says it was a cougar. I think that's very funny. But the terror dog chases him to Tavern on the Green, and here's where I have another personal connection to the film. I don't think it was because of Ghostbusters, but my lovely wife and I honeymooned in New York in 1987.
Okay.
And part of our little travel agency package was some dinners, some certificates for dinner at various places. Mm-hmm. It was a travel agent's dream.
Right.
And lo and behold, one of the gift certificates was for Tavern on the Green. So we went to Tavern on the Green. And once the waiter saw that the tip was already taken care of by the gift certificate, mm-hmm. the waiter proceeded to treat us, it was one of the highlights of our vacation, with that New York rudeness that you only hear about. I mean, openly insulting me about certain things. And so, Tavern on the Green recently closed.
Right.
and I'm glad because they were mean to me. And the final personal connection is a summer or two ago, my family and I went back to New York for a vacation, and we saw some Broadway shows, and we were staying in Tribeca. And one night, my wife and I were walking around, and we walked past a fire station. And I said, why does that fire station look so familiar? Where have we seen that before? And I said, I think this is the fire station in Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. And we walked into the entrance, and lo and behold, they have hanging there mm-hmm. in the entranceway the sign from Ghostbusters 2. And one of the firefighters was standing in the door, and I said, so this is the place. And he said, yep.
Do you think it's telling that Columbia Pictures or whoever produced the movie was willing to part with the sign from Ghostbusters 2, but that the sign from the original Ghostbusters is perhaps a more valuable piece of memorabilia?
Well, I was wondering that earlier today. I'm assuming they use the same fire station. It's interesting, because when you watch the movie, that block really does look like a demilitarized zone, which is a Ramis joke. And that entire area has undergone gentrification and yuppification because now it is, you know, with Robert De Niro and the Tribeca Film Festival.
Right.
And that whole area is very, very different. But I thought it was interesting because when I first saw the fire station, I didn't see the Ghostbuster sign inside. You had to sort of walk inside to see it. Mm-hmm. And it's iconic.
Yeah.
Where have I seen that before?
It doesn't make any sense to me that in Ghostbusters 2, that the characters within the film would make themselves a new sign, and on the new sign, the little ghost logo would be holding up a 2. Well, as though they know they're in a sequel.
That's the merchandising people, or Dan Aykroyd, who was suddenly on a campaign for world peace. See, it's not a 2, Patrick. It's a peace sign. Like Ringo Starr tells us, peace and love, peace and love.
Are you a fan of Ghostbusters 2?
I think Ghostbusters 2 is flawed. I've heard stories that one was really rushed, that they really had a deadline that they couldn't meet. I like parts of it. I like Peter McNichol's performance.
Okay.
Obviously you don't.
I'm just not a fan of the whole movie, and it breaks my heart because I love Ghostbusters so much. And even as, I guess, a 12-year-old who was not very discerning, because you're 12 and you tend to like what you see, but even as a 12-year-old, I saw Ghostbusters 2 and thought, that movie's not that good.
I don't think we need Sigourney Weaver and Dan Aykroyd, Sigourney Weaver and Bill Murray got together, and now they're estranged, and there's a baby. And for some reason, Janine is very interested in the Harold Ramis character in part one, and suddenly they pair her with Louis Tully for hijinks that don't appear. The River of Slime is odd. I do like, and clearly this was their attempt to outdo the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, I really like animating the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
And walking her down, and this is a symbol. So I like that a lot, and any movie that uses Higher and Higher by, I believe that's Sam Cooke? I may be wrong. But it is a troubling, flawed film. And I'm wondering, supposedly there's 3, or is there?
It's been talked about for a long time, mostly because want it.
When the game came out, there was a
lot
of talk
and people
about
want it, and Harold Ramis has hinted at it, and Bill Murray keeps coming out and saying, it's not going to happen. Although he did hint at the fact that if there is a third one, he would be playing a ghost of Peter Venkman, I assume. I don't know. A script supposedly, the original Ghostbusters were only going to appear in some sort of mentor capacity, which is a terrible idea because now you have Ghostbusters the Next Generation, and that's a terrible idea. A script was commissioned for 2 writers from The Office. I'm going to get their names wrong, Lee Eisenberg and Gene Zupinski, I've got it wrong. Who play like the delivery men for Advanced Refrigeration on that show. Mm-hmm. They were going to be writing a script. Then they wrote a script for a movie that came out last summer called Year One that Harold Ramis directed. And the movie did terribly and was savaged by critics and all of a sudden the talk of them writing Ghostbusters 3 went away.
Year one is really bad.
Yeah.
And I'm a big Harold Ramis fan.
As am I, and it broke my heart.
He moved back to the Chicago area.
Yeah.
And I actually see him all the time.
Do you?
I do.
That's awesome.
I run into him a lot.
Oh, man.
Probably more than he'd like.
I love Egon. And again, he wasn't going to play that part. I guess the movie was originally written for Belushi.
That's what I always heard.
Aykroyd. I think John Candy was supposed to take the Rick Moranis part. And I guess there's talk that Eddie Murphy was possibly going to play Winston. And that he would have joined the group much earlier in the movie, but he ended up doing Beverly Hills Cop, which is the only movie that outgrossed Ghostbusters in 1984.
That's interesting, because I had always heard that it was originally written for Belushi, and I always wondered, would Belushi be the Venkman part?
I assume so.
Yeah, it seems like that would be a fit, although I gotta say, Murray really turns it into something that's very...
Every line he has is funny, and as you said, it became sort of the template for every Bill Murray character. I mean, he was already sort of doing it in Meatballs and Stripes, just Mr. Sarcastic one-liner. But Ghostbusters, it is an art form.
Another line that I find myself saying a lot, because this movie is endlessly quotable, is at one point, Bill Murray, as a Venkman, is very, very upset. Patrick will tell you in just a second what scene this is. And he says, "Mother Puss Bucket." That's a wonderful swear word.
It's the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
Okay, because...
Aim for the Flat Top, by the way, makes me laugh every time. And that's Aykroyd when they're shooting at Zool, when Zool finally appears.
One of my favorite shots in the film...
I'm sorry, Gozer.
Gozer
the Gozerian.
The lithe little minx?
Sure. Yeah. Or Limber?
Nimble little minx. One of my favorite shots in the film is when they're on top of the building and the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man is climbing up the side of the building a la King Kong. There's one shot where the Ghostbusters are actually having some effect and it looks like they're going to do away with Gozer, mm-hmm. and his facial expression changes.
Mm-hmm.
And for a brief moment, we get angry, quizzical Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. And it's an amazing thing. But again, that was a physical effect. They actually sculpted a Stay Puft Marshmallow Man and then cast it in some sort of material, because I hate CGI. And here's another reason to hate CGI. When I was watching the film earlier today, I was looking at the backgrounds out Dana's apartment window when she's in the apartment, mm-hmm. and especially when they're on top of the building at the end of the film.
Right.
And the New York backgrounds are not photorealistic.
Mm-hmm.
They're stylized.
Mm-hmm.
To me, they look like that set behind Letterman's desk, where it's idealized, it's stylized.
Right. It's New York in quotation marks.
Right, and I like it so much because it's a fictional New York. It's a magical New York.
Right.
And it's very beautiful to look at, especially in widescreen.
I had a friend of mine who has been on this podcast, his name is Doug, you know Doug.
Yes.
Watched Ghostbusters a few months ago and tweeted or Facebooked or IM'd or texted, I don't know, ripped on the last line of the movie being Ernie Hudson saying, "I love this town." And I disagree with that. I think that line coming from that character sums up so much of the movie.
Oh, I'm...
I think it's a great last line. I like that he's the one that says it.
I was just shaking my head, which is incomprehensible.
You heard that, right?
You heard the air being moved around my head. I completely agree. I love this town. I love this city. It's a great...
Because after what we've just seen, what line would be better? They're covered in marshmallow because they just...
Which brings us to my final point.
Okay.
Again, good movies have foreshadowing of one form or another, that the script is sort of this whole that constantly refers to itself in various ways. Ever since I saw this film for the first time, I've wondered. At the beginning of the film, we are introduced to the slime, that these ghosts leave behind, and it's gross. And in the library, Bill Murray has a lot of fun collecting the sample, and it's on his hand, and he has to shoot it, and it's really gross. And
here's your mucus.
Yeah, and then in the hotel, he's the one who gets slime. Right. I feel so funky, and it's really, really gross. Is it just a joke, and I think it's a really funny joke, or is it a weird form of the film being aware of itself that because Venkman gets slimed in the hotel, at the end, they are all thoroughly marshmallowed, except Bill Murray.
Even as a kid, I always...
He's got hardly any.
I always took that as a joke about his celebrity, about his star status, that he's the lead of the movie and perhaps, you know, the most famous actor, not just Ghostbuster. Right. And so it's just a joke that everyone is covered in it with a crazy amount and he has a little dab on his head.
But even in the reality of the film, mm-hmm. especially given that he was slimed right. in the hotel right. building, the Venkman character would find a way to get out of the way.
Yeah.
Or hide behind
right.
someone else.
Yeah, right.
Or get
right.
out.
Right.
And maybe you're right in terms of the celebrity, because I think it does pay off, because at the very end of the film, this might even be during the credits,
yeah, it is.
There's a wonderful shot where he kisses Sigourney Weaver.
Right.
Tying up that plot strand.
Right.
And certainly that's a lot more standard Hollywood or standard heroic if... in fact, I really like that shot. And it looks very genuine. Sigourney Weaver raises her hand and puts it on the back of his head. It's mm-hmm. very, very romantic. It's very short. But that wouldn't work as well if he had gotten his marshmallow
right.
as the rest. Right. And I also love when they're helping Dana get out of her little stone prison of being the terror dog, mm-hmm. And we see that Tully is having the same problem. He says, "Go get the little guy," so that he can be alone once again
right.
with Sigourney
right.
Weaver. It's clever.
And at that point, has Bill Murray even met Moranis?
Wow.
I don't know. Watching that last night, that occurred to me, that he calls him the little guy because he has no idea really who he is. He's away with Dana while they're doing all the stuff with Rick Moranis. I guess he meets him in the firehouse when Walter Peck shuts down the grid and it explodes. They're technically all there together because Moranis escapes from there.
Well, plus there's a shot in Dana's hallway where he's leaving
oh, right,
the apartment
right.
with that little machine.
right.
And Tully once again has been locked
right.
out, but they don't
right.
converse.
Right.
And,
right.
and clearly that's that. Perhaps... we've made you want to watch this film again.
I hope so.
Which you should, because this summer has been very disappointing. We'll be talking about that after Piranha 3D comes out. And it's very wonderful to revisit an old friend.
Yeah, it's not a flawless movie, but I would say it's a perfect movie.
Yeah. And... one that the passage of time hasn't, destroyed. One more quick thing. Sitting in front of us for this entire podcast were the recently released Mattel action figures, the Ghostbusters, little 7-inch figures, and there's Bill Murray, and there's Slimer, and there's Winston Zeddemore, there's Ernie Hudson, and there's Dan Aykroyd. The Egon figure, this would be the Harold Ramis figure, was like a Comic-Con exclusive something, and you couldn't get it, and they only made two of them, and they're going for really big prices on eBay. What you need to do is find one of those, or perhaps you have one and you really don't want it, and send it to Patrick.
Email me, fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
And if you can prove that you have one, he'll find a way to get it from you.
These are like real licensed movie figures. This is not
something
the Egon character from that real Ghostbusters cartoon with the blonde pompadour.
Mattel has a special little
Someone
boutique business.
Egon was David Bowie.
Mattel has a little boutique business called MattyCollector.com. How about this? If you work for MattyCollector.com and you enjoy this podcast, Look, I'm a public high school teacher. I have little or no money. I certainly can't afford the eBay prices for Egon. So someone, send me one. Thank you.
Bye, guys.